Historiography is in agreement on the cultural centrality of Giulio Camillo del Miglio, rhetorician, philosopher, kabbalist, magician, alchemist. His vision of the world and of the human being was fully part of one of the most flourishing cultural trends of the European Renaissance: the consolidation of the Platonic tradition, which had been welded with the ambiguous tradition of the Hermetic writings and the Jewish Kabbalah. My purpose this morning is to start from this well-explored cultural ground and to probe more deeply into certain aspects that historiography has not focused on as deserved. In this sense, a central role is played by the weight that the nascent emphasis on anatomical investigation exerted on Camillo's reflection, and, vice versa, the influence of the cultural experiences Camillo referred to on anatomy and its material tools. The grandiose project on which Camillo worked throughout his life was fully inserted into the ideology of the Venetian academies: the construction, mental and material, of a great theater of memory, or of the world, it's the same. Various reconstructions of this impressive mnemonic encyclopedic device have been attempted by the scholars. Here we have an anonymous reconstruction. We can see the observer was not sitting in the stands, but was on the stage, where he could observe in front of him the spectacle of memorable images arranged according to the cosmological astrological order, from the intelligible to the celestial to the terrestrial. Behind the images, which therefore emblematized every aspect of reality, were crammed papers containing textual places by exemplary authors, especially Cicero, on the subject represented. Apparently, therefore, this device seemed only useful for the rhetoricians, who could always have at his disposal the material with which to construct every possible discourse. It is no coincidence that the structure was described as a soul made visible. All the concept that the human mind could conceive in its own invisible depths were here visually unveiled. But in reality, the aim was much more complex. In his Trattato dell'Imitazione, Camillo illustrated how to imitate exemplary texts. Camillo explained that to imitate correctly, the writer did not have to steal words or rhetorical figures as they appeared in classical text, but it was necessary to go back to the topical order from which these originated, namely the logical mechanism that produced them, by stripping them of their cogitant aspects. Therefore, Camillo exhorted to perform a sort of dissection on exemplary text in order to find the universal logical norms that governed them. This process was compared to a real anatomical experiment that he had personally witnessed. Indeed, he added that, "I remember that in Bologna, an excellent anatomist closed a human body in a completely perforated box and then exposed it to the current of a river, which, through those holes, in a few days consumed and carried away all the flesh of that body, which then showed the marvelous secrets of nature, only the bones and nerves being left. This body, supported only by bones, I compare to the model of eloquence, supported only by matter and by the scheme." Probably, the mysterious anatomist could have been Berengario da Carpi. In any case, just like the anatomist had to remove the superficial layers of the human body in order to grasp its hidden and the universal functioning, the same was true for the rhetoricians who wanted to discover the topical orders of their literary models. Similar comparisons could also be found in the letter to Marco Antonio Flaminio from several years before. Here, among other things, a primitive version of the mnemonic system of the theater was outlined, in which the structural model was not provided neither by an architectural work or by the astrological system. The first was too humble, the second too complex, according to the young Camillo. Wrote Camillo at this point, "We turned all our thought to the marvelous fabrica of the human body. As a microcosm, the human body could provide a correspondence with everything in the world." Furthermore, Camillo added that his interest was also due for having been shown to me by an excellent anatomist the divine functioning of two human bodies from limb to limb. If the use of the human body as a mnemonic place was actually a fairly common practice, both in the Middle Ages and in Renaissance, what is significant to underline in this passage is how, once again, the visual impact and the order that emerged from the anatomized body illustrated the mnemonic operation that Camillo wanted to aim for. However, the theme of the human being as a microcosm here acquired a dimension of artificiality. Indeed, Camillo used to connote the body the lemma fabrica, derived from Cicero, and moreover, the Ciceronian source was explicitly declared. But fabrica was also used among other occurrences in the specifically architectural field. It was the process of building the edifice. Cicero, in relation to the body of animals, spoke of admirabilis fabrica membrorum, and in relation to the human body of incredibilis fabrica nature. The body, therefore, began to be seen as a compound on which the human being could radically act through a specific arts. To enrich this triangulation that we have established between body, world, and architecture, we have also to consider a well-known pattern of the Accademia degli Infiammati, frequented by both Camillo and Vesalius, namely Daniele Barbaro, who, in his successful commented edition of Vitruvius de Architectura, explicitly spoke of rhetoricians as architects of the discourse, architetti dell'orazione. The ut pictura poesis was thus reworked as ut architectura oratio. However, as we have observed, the two models that had been discarded in the letter to Flaminio would have prevailed in the definitive preparation of Camillo's mnemonic system. Indeed, the final theater was governed by the theatrical architectural model fused with the astrological system of celestial images, recalling an already Vitruvian motive of correspondence between the theatrical plant and the zodiacal system. Nevertheless, it was also described as an artificial mind or soul, thus retaining certain instances of the body system. In the final conception of the project, the mnemonic model based on the human being as a microcosm was therefore clearly preserved. Thus, the lemma fabrica, together with the use of an architectural structure, makes us understand how Camillo was already placing emphasis on the artificial essence of both the body, opened by the anatomist, and the soul, opened by the rhetorician philosopher. It should be remembered that almost 20 years after this letter, Vesalius published the Fundamental De Humani Corporis Fabrica with clear references to all the cultural tradition mentioned above. After all, many of the greatest experiences of the culture of the 16th century, all related to each other, coincided in the cultural experience represented by Camillo's investigation, which focused its conditions of existence in the visual language of memory and in the self-control of the imaginary. And Camillo himself made it explicit in several circumstances: the rhetorical poetic production, the revaluation and emancipation of figurative art, the new anatomical approach. It is sufficient to think of the famous passage from Aristotle's Poetics, which, at the time of Camillo, saw its own rediscovery and massive diffusion among the vast public of intellectuals, underlining the philosophical and truth-revealing weight of literary production. The poet's task was to succeed not in slavishly imitating reality as it appears, but in purging it of all accidental events. In poetic imitation, namely a perfective imitation, the universal essence of the human being had to be represented in all its purity, which has not given in ordinary experience. Furthermore, pictorial comparisons continually intervened in Aristotle Poetics, and the comparison between a literary work and organic body certainly did not have a secondary role, radicalizing the link between textuality, memorability, and visuality. But the same anatomy during the 16th century did not escape from all these cultural atmospheres. Among the most revolutionary tools of the century, the so-called anatomical theaters certainly had a privileged role. It is therefore not misleading to say that medical and anatomical discoveries were set up in the theater. It was precisely towards the end of the 16th century that the so-called anatomical theaters began to become stable structures, no longer ephemeral. This, among other things, happened precisely starting from the Po Valley environments, where the need for the new encyclopedia of knowledge was so acutely felt and where Camillo had circulated for a long time. After all, even anatomy had been absorbed in the humanistic project of refounding knowledge perpetrated in the academies. As we can derive by one of the first examples of a stable anatomical theater, that of Padua, completed in 1595, the image of the classical theater and its mnemonic role were radically taken up. However, a more emblematic case for our purpose is provided by the later anatomical theater of Bologna. Designed in 1647 by Antonio Palucci, the part on which it is necessary to dwell is the Cofre de Selin, decorated in 1645 by Antonio Levanti. It represents the allegories of 14 constellations to which Apollo is added at the center of everything. The patron god of medicine is therefore surrounded by a series of constellations, each of which had to have a precise astrological link with a specific part of the human body. This astrological system was already present in Camillo's Idea del Teatro. Beyond the specific variants regarding the relationship between constellation part of the body. Another significant detail is that in the theater of Camillo, the central corridor was dedicated to the sun, thus also giving a central role to the image of Apollo. Obviously, we do not intend here to trace Camillo's influence on Levanti, direct or mediated, but rather to detect the presence of certain cultural instances still active in the 17th century. An even more significant detail in the same direction is given by the fact that the constellations dominate the lower space of the actual structure of the anatomical theater. To understand the importance of this factor, it is necessary to move almost a century ahead of Camillo's activity and change country, going to England. Here we met the Hermetic philosopher Robert Fludd. The second section of the second volume of his monumental work, De Utrisque Cosmi, dealing with the human technique, there is a chapter dedicated to the art of memory. The architecture referenced was once again a theater, and once again it merged with the astrological system. Indeed, Flood distinguished between an ars rotunda and an ars quadrata. The first referred to natural, namely spiritual elements, the second to artificial, namely corporeal elements. Flood proposed a fusion of these two systems. In his memory system, the ars rotunda provided the celestial orbits as mnemonical places, while the ars quadrata provided the real architectures, always as places. The specifically human arts was therefore made naturalized, namely closer to the metaphysical design of reality. If Camillo therefore used only one theater, already intrinsically fused with an astrological system, the sapiential mnemonic system built by Flood diverged, since beyond the certainly not classical but typically Elizabethan plan of the theater, it employed more than one. This theater also appeared in an apparently extrinsic way with respect to the astral system. Flood proposed the design of a theater which, however, had to be used in two ways. Indeed, the same theater provided the scheme for creating two theaters, one Eastern and one Western, united by the same plan but of a different colors, one with daytime colors, the other with the nocturnal colors. These theaters were physically placed in the astral system of planetary spheres. Flood's drawing on the page adjacent to that of the theater showed the example of two theaters within the sign of Aries. In any case, the fusion between the two systems, the architectural and the astral, was therefore different from that of Camillo. Flood then seems to relate in a heterogeneous way. However, as Francis Yates noted with regard to the image of the theater, attention must be paid to the detail of the ceiling, which is absent in Flood's drawing. Indeed, most likely, he based the design of his theater on the real building of the Globe Theater, and usually the theaters of this period had a ceiling decorated precisely with the system of celestial spheres. After all, already in the construction of the Teatro Olimpico of Vicenza, wanted by the Academia Olimpica, a cluster of Venetian intellectuals influenced by Camillo, great attention had been paid to the ceiling, patent like a sky, even if in this case clearly not astrological. Moreover, as Yeats, we must consider that in Flood's text, both the design of the celestial spheres and that of mnemonic theater are paginated in such a way that, closing the volume, they overlap perfectly. This fact seems to want to reaffirm the mutual reflection of the two systems, but also a more concrete structural detail regarding the ceiling of the theater. In the light of all this, a mirroring game of analogies, very dear to the Hermetic tradition of the Renaissance, is revealed. Therefore, not only were the two theaters to be imagined as extrinsically inserted in the celestial orbits, but internally, they in turn reflected the same seal of those orbits. This brings Flood's theater closer to Camillo's theater. Once again, there is a strong connection between transcendent and immanent, between metaphysical design and the human work. Returning to Bologna, it is therefore extremely significant to observe a ceiling sky full of astrological references just above the anatomical theater. However, as we said, in the current state of research, it is not yet possible to seek a more precise network of influences and purposes among the various artists involved in its construction. In any case, at this point, the influence of the Hermetic Platonic and academic cultural environments, although probably superficial, is difficult to deny and constitutes a precious testimony of a still active dialogue between two worlds, that of the scientific revolution and that of the Hermetic culture. At this time, it's still hard to separate in a clear way. The strain of visuality and the aesthetic and memorial power of the imaginative faculties of the human soul, spectator of the complex spectacle of the nature and the human body, still remain fundamental tools for both anatomists and philosophers, hermetic or not. However, I think it is significant to dwell again on a detail of the ceiling, on which the interpreters do not seem to have paid the due attention. Indeed, if you take as a reference the 1668 woodcut attributed to Matteo Barboni and Lorenzo Tinti, beyond the inverted arrangement of Andromeda and Sagittarius, we note a detail that it's not of secondary importance compared to the real ceiling. The figure of Apollo is vertically oriented, giving symmetry to the overall composition, but also staticity. This difference brings out even more the strong dynamism of a real ceiling, given precisely by the diagonal positioning of Apollo within its octagonal coffer. Blocking Apollo's dance in this position seems to convey a circular trend to the figure, as if the god were to progressively indicate all the astrological figures that surround him. After all, the same adoption of a central octagonal coffer used only for Apollo seems to make a movement like the circular one within a square frame more natural. If this trend brings us even closer to the circular trend of the illustration of celestial orbits that have been seen in Flood, but were also traceable in Camillo's Theater, it also brings us back to another tradition, that of the Lullian wheels. At the time, this tradition had been readily absorbed both by the treatises of the art of memory and by the major philosophical and hermetic addresses. Indeed, the graphic representation of Lullian combinatorics within moving wheel had captured the attention of Renaissance intellectuals who merged them in the most disparate context. If the most radical experimenter of the fusion between the art of memory and the combinatorial wheels was undoubtedly Giordano Bruno, this union was actually somehow already present in one of the first printed mnemotechnical treatises, the Ars Memorativa by Jacobus Publicius. Indeed, in a complex system of syllabic construction, he proposed a figure made of combinatorial wheels, in which the rotating dynamism was emphasized through the vermis, placed in the center, which could rotate freely, fixed to the page with a string. However, the image used by Giordano Bruno in the Articuli Advertus Mathematicus to indicate the different types of mnemonic places seem closer to the case of Apollo. At the center, there is a human figure, this time fixed, but whose diagonal arrangement, both of the body and of the open arms, suggests a similar circular dynamism, although the figure is inserted in a square space. Once again, we do not claim to trace a direct link, but at least to detect the choice of analogous iconographic solutions in a cultural context and practices that end up constantly referring to. The dynamism of the combinatorial wheels, their visual strength, their reabsorption into mnemonic system based on the rotation of celestial spheres, the mirroring of celestial world, theater, and the human body. Within the theater of Bologna, the viewers of the anatomical spectacle constantly had before their eyes not only the progressive unfolding of the mechanism of the human body, but also the rotating dance of Apollo and the constellations, the corporeal fabrica and the celestial fabrica found themselves together in the theatrical fabrica, a place of training and control of the imaginative and mnemonic visuality. In this context, the disciplinary and above all methodological distance to which contemporaneity has become accustomed disappeared, showing us the profound link of theoretical and operational practices among philosophers, magicians, artists, and anatomists, all interested in the border area of the faculties between the physical and the incorporeal of the human being. After all, was not memory the mother of all the muses? Grazie.